On today's episode, we are talking about technology with the CEO of AccuRx, Jacob Haddad. And you might be thinking, what is technology to do with improving my finances? As a GP partner, this technology is helping me to deal with the increasing workload and the decreasing funding. And I think you're going to hear how AccuRx have really helped GPs, but now they're moving into the secondary care space to try to make some just simple changes there, mainly around communication that just make doctors and other clinicians' lives easier. Then about halfway through, we take a bit of a tangent. We start talking about how AI is going to impact in healthcare, and Jacob's got some really interesting thoughts about that, like cutting through the noise into how this could actually help us. We then move on to talk a bit about the demise of Babylon. Again, some really interesting thoughts there that I hadn't really heard expressed elsewhere. Then finally, I know that loads of you are interested in getting into health tech or maybe just getting out of being a full-time doctor. I totally understand that. So we talk about when Jacob's hiring a doctor at his technology company, what does he look for and what skills do you need? And I think you're going to be impressed there because I think you've already got a lot of the skills that he mentioned. So something a bit different. I hope that this is useful. Thank you so much for listening and watching on YouTube. Let's get into today's episode.
The Medics Money podcast helps doctors, dentists, and other professionals make better financial decisions. Hosted by myself, Dr. Tommy Perkins, a GP.
And by me, Dr. Ed Cantelow, a GP, but also a chartered accountant and chartered tax advisor.
This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute any form of advice, and tax allowances and rates are subject to change.
All right, it's my pleasure to welcome back to this episode Mr. Jacob Haddad from AccuRx. Hi, Jacob.
Morning, Tommy. Thanks so much for having me back. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. We were just saying before we came on that you kindly presented at our conference last week, which I couldn't make because I've got this X-Fix on my finger if you're watching on YouTube. So I couldn't make it, but I heard that the conference was good, right?
Yeah, it was a really, really, really good day. Really great bunch of attendees who were quite entrepreneurial and sharing ideas. I really, really enjoyed it. And what happened to your finger? How's that?
I chopped my thumb, index and middle finger clean off using electric saw. Amazingly, the NHS, incredible team at St. George's and the paramedics and HEMS put it back on and it's all working really well. It's just my middle finger just needs a bit of help. So it's just got that. This is, I don't want to patronize you, but this is what we call an X-Fix. So it's anchored into the bone there and it's anchored into the bone there and there. And it's just trying to heal the gap there. It's not healed. So we're going to, we are going to, an incredibly talented surgical team, nothing to do with me, are going to put a bit of bone in the gap next week, actually. So by the time this comes out, that finger will either be back to life or chopped off. Could be the last time you see it. But let's not dwell on that. Let's just get into, a lot of our audience are GPs, but most of them probably not. So give me like the 2-minute summary of what is AccuRx? How did you get started? And then I want to get into how you're going to help the NHS, basically, or how you are helping the NHS.
We see healthcare as a communication industry. And what I mean by that is when we go and talk to staff on the front line and say, what did you do today? Or I ask my wife, who's a hematologist, at the end of the day, what did you do today? It's some version of had to make a referral, get a second opinion, coordinate this patient's care, get this patient in for bloods, or coordinate their discharge. It's communication. And often that communication is really, really hard, as everyone's familiar with. It's lots of waiting on hold and chasing things up and dictating things and bleeping and switchboards. That's the problem we're focused on. Now, obviously, 50 years ago, healthcare wasn't, you just saw a doctor, they told you what to do. It was this like knowledge industry. And now it's become so specialized with different roles and different orgs that it's now delivered. It's a communication industry delivered by teams. So we've got a vision that everyone involved in a patient's care can communicate with each other. Generally, that's very uncontroversial. Generally, it's also pretty hard to do because we've got to get the whole health system using us to communicate. Our bread and butter is in general practice, where pretty much all GP practices use us to message their patients. But we're growing quite a bit now into other settings, so acutes and community and pharmacies, but a particular focus on acutes. So that's what we do. And it actually came about, we spent our first year and a half focused on antibiotic prescribing in general practice and couldn't really get anywhere. But we had this little bit at the end of our decision support where you could send some advice to a patient about their sore throat or their UTI. and you could send it by text message, and people loved that bit. Went and spent about 6 months living in one GP practice, just experimenting and building different unscalable prototypes. Really, really cool stuff. But it was there that we realized that what everyone was dealing with was communication challenges.
Yeah, and if you want to know what that looks like in like real life, my experience of AcuRx was at the start of the pandemic in my practice, we could send text messages, but it was just like bulk text messaging. So I couldn't just send a text message to a patient. I had to go upstairs, say, admin, could we schedule this text message for tonight? We always had to send them in the evening. I don't know why. I'd never done a video consultation, and we did do telephone consultations, but really we were quite traditional, like mostly face-to-face. The pandemic hit, and suddenly I needed to send text messages and do video consultations. And the current software just had no provision for that, or nothing that works, let's just say. And someone said, oh, try AcuRx. You just install this on your computer. Now, I was like, every time you try and install something on an NHS computer, it just doesn't work. It's contact the administrator. You need to run an update. So I was like, oh, this is never going to work. I clicked the link, and then it came on, and I logged in, and I was like, well, this is going all right so far. And then I got to the bit where I was like, I don't know if you of course you remember this, but in the early days, you had to use your phone, and then you had this sort of like bolt-on bit of software that helped you do the video consult. And I was like, oh, this is where it's going to fall down. And I was like, no, I'm actually consulting with a patient within literally about 15 minutes. And then I was just like, how have you done that? So when Jacob says like he's helping communication, that's how it helped us. And now it's evolved massively into Total Triage. So if you don't know what Total Triage is, like you're not a GP, then it's like getting the information you need to make sure that a patient gets to see the right person in the right time frame and with the right clinician. And AcuRx is invaluable for that. I can't imagine the tech side of things, how hard that was to do. Although I've got a lot of respect for people who either, because yours is a software as a service business, right? I've got a lot of respect for people who ship physical products or do physical things, because we ran our conference last week. So it was a 2-day thing. We had about 250 people, I think, over 2 days. And it was a total nightmare. Like the conference was great, but organizing a physical business, I don't know, like I'm never going to run a business which ships physical products, and I'm not going to be diversifying into organizing like these 5,000 people conferences. But yours is like a SaaS business for healthcare, basically, right?
It is. And it's funny you talk about how easy it was to install, because 2018 for us was the year of how do we make it so that anyone who hits our website who's never heard of us within 5 minutes is installed. And I vividly remember, speaking of shipping physical goods, I vividly remember a heated conversation of should we send out CD-ROMs to practices where their internet couldn't handle the download. We managed to find a sort of software solution around that. But I know what you mean in terms of having a lot of admiration for some of the like craft of physical products. But yeah, to be able to do things at scale, we're very, very focused on the software. Total Triage is an interesting one because for us, patient messaging, being able to invite a patient to book, being able to send a Flori and collect structured data, all of these things, innovative staff can just pick up and use. And you have a sort of curve of adoption where your most innovative use that, and then you get the early adopters and you work your way through. And you could dip your toes in the water, so to speak. Whereas Total Triage is different. Total Triage, you have to take this leap of faith, and it's not just you using software, you're actually working in a completely different operating model, a much more modern operating model, where appointments are no longer first line treatment or first line management. Appointments are second line, and you're trying to do as much as you can, particularly asynchronously. So it's been a big shift for us because we are a software as a service business, but I think we're also figuring out how do we do this implementation change management piece really, really well, because the software, doing the software well is hard, but it's still, I think, the easy bit compared to actually like changing how people work, whether that's in general practice or in hospitals. And what's interesting for us from our vantage is seeing all the innovation that's happened in general practice with communication, which ultimately has just shifted productivity. Ultimately, it's one of the main reasons that general practice with a smaller workforce is doing more activity, because they're doing more asynchronously. How do we map that over to other parts of the health system? How do we move away from like our unit of delivery of healthcare is only appointments, which is also like the societal thing of patients. Like, I want to see my doctor, I want an appointment. But until we do that, it's going to be really, really hard to find productivity improvements, because a 10-minute appointment 20 years ago took 10 minutes of a doctor's time, and a 10-minute appointment today takes 10 minutes of a doctor's time. So I'd say that that's a big point of maturation for us, is working out how to do the change management well.
Yeah, definitely. As you say, like, you've got the early adopters like me. We're always going to, if we see something we think looks good, we're just going to go for it. But then there's people that rightly have concerns, questions. Will my, if I open my appointment book up, will I get swamped? And there is a kind of argument that you can have supply induced demand, whereby if it's super easy to contact the GP practice, you may get extra demand, not being our experience, not being a lot of people's experience. But there's all these reasons, which I'm sure you heard at the conference last week. And that kind of brings me around to, so you've done the text messaging, you've got all that, the link booking thing is amazing, but then you've got this blueprint for recovering access. And I'm glad that you mentioned that fact that the GP workforce has shrunk, but the productivity is still going up. And that's not been the case throughout other parts of the NHS, unfortunately. We could argue whether that's a good or a bad thing for GPs. I think GPs and their teams are just working incredibly hard. But no doubt, some of these tools like AccuX are helping that productivity. So what's this blueprint for recovering access? Because this is literally like a toolkit if you want to start total triage, basically, right?
Yeah, so what we consistently found is that there is a cohort of practices, and it's 10 to 15%, it's not completely binary, but 10 to 15% of practices that we go to where they just run completely differently. And you go in and there's this like eerie calmness. There's spaces in the car park because the waiting room isn't overflowing. You can talk to reception staff without feeling guilty because the phone is not ringing off the hook. They've got time to go and make a cup of tea, coffee, and sit together. And then you look at the work they're doing and patients are getting in touch, and 7 minutes later, they're hearing back from the GP asking, sending some questions, more information about their UTI, and then GP's reviewing it and they're sending off a script. And it's just a very, very different experience. And so what we've tried to do with this blueprint is say, okay, how can we scale that up to all of practices? Because of a lot of the fears, exactly like you talk about, like supply-induced demand. Because the flip side is there are also a lot of practices who implemented online consultations and things got worse. Like, they just got more overwhelmed because they had this unmet demand of patients who couldn't get through on the phone or could get through, but the appointments are gone. Suddenly now that you can see that it's in an inbox, you've got to deal with it. And they got completely swamped. So what is it about those 10 to 15% of practices that they've implemented this? And with small practices, big practices, urban, rural, different levels of deprivation, everyone has the same staffing shortages and constraints. What is it about the way they're running, and how can we replicate that in other practices? So that's the focus of Blueprint, is like spreading those learnings. And that's us spreading those learnings. That's us connecting practices to other practices who've done it, because they're far more compelling and have far more nuances and insights to share than we do, talking to another practice, especially a local one or similar size practice who can do that. And so we've put some case studies in there. We've got practices where, I think one example in there is St Andrew's Health Centre, quite near us in London. 99% of requests coming in are dealt with in 48 hours. And that's actually quite common across lots of total triage practices. On average, patients getting in touch, hear back in half an hour. And that's just like a huge, what we find is that patient behavior then shifts. This is where the supply induced demand bit gets interesting, because initially there is certainly some of that, and we hear that. And even over time, there's probably a small amount, but it's outweighed by the fact that the patients realize, when I get in touch, I'll actually get the advice, get what I need. So I'm not going to book an appointment just in case for 6 weeks out. Oh, it seems like a weird emoji thing.
Cool.
I don't know how to redo it again. I'm not going to book an appointment just in case. I'm not going to, if my GP says, let's see how this goes for a few weeks and get in touch if your back pain's still bad or whatever it is. Patients are happy with that because they don't feel fobbed off. They know they've got a link. They can just reply and get back in touch. Patients are more comfortable sharing what the problem is with reception staff so that they can help triage it. There's just this big shift in patient behavior.
And I think that is a big hurdle for a lot of, because obviously on our partnership course, next cohort starting February 21st, go to GP course, medicsmoney.co.uk/GP course to sign up. I might see Jacob on it as well. But yeah, on that, we've got a lot of people who've made the leap, some people that are thinking about the leap, and some people that they just can't comprehend ever making. And this sort of supply induced demand thing is a worry. But what I've found is, if patient, like you said, if patients, it just goes back to communication, isn't it? In the past, we would just, if someone phoned up and said, I'd like to see a doctor, we'd book them in with the doctor. They might sit down and say, doctor, I'd like you to fill in this form. And you're like, oh, admin could have done this. Or they come and see me and say, my shoulder's hurting. I'm like, I've got a physio that could be way better than helping you with your shoulder. So I think if you've got a lot of our staff, that is the pharmacist, the physios, the mental health team, like that is a game changer, but only if you utilize them properly. And Total Triage helps us to utilize them properly, because someone phones up asking they've got a sore shoulder. We run them through the Flori pre-built question, super simple to use. Like, it's so easy to use. And our patients, our demographic are older than average, but yet they still manage it. And then they get to see the right person, the physio, in the right time frame, first time. And what we found is that we were wasting less appointments. Now, it's very rare that someone sits down in front of me and says something like, and then I think, oh, you could have been seen by an R staff. The flip side of that is actually, we, for GPs and some of our other clinicians, we've had to switch to 15-minute appointments, because I was, as a GP, I was just seeing what I needed to see. And it was too hard. There was no like easy cases. But from a kind of resource utilization point of view, that is good, because the right patients are seeing the right person time. Like, none of that sit down, oh, you got to go somewhere else. Because as a patient, that's incredibly frustrating. You wait for your appointment, you're all excited, you sit down, and the person goes, oh, you know what, you need to see my friend, not me. And you're like, oh no, I've got another 8-week wait.
We've seen a few of these things. So with the R staff and the multidisciplinary team in general, because lots of practices have been innovating with that for years, one pattern we saw is practices would have a pharmacist, maybe they'd have a physio, and their appointments would fill up, but they wouldn't actually be shifting anything from GPs. And so actually changing what happens at the front door, like you outline, is the only way to do that. And same with continuity, same with working out, not just always continuity, but who are the patients where it really, really matters? And who are the patients where actually they, what they care about is speed, because of they just need to be dealt with soon. You speak about the back pain example you give is really interesting, because we started hearing practices saying things like, I send out this back pain Flori, and we do that now for all back pain. And we've actually picked up things we wouldn't have picked up if we were rushing through that in, you know, a 5-minute appointment, because a patient's taking time to go through and answer things. We picked up 2 quarter equiners that we wouldn't have picked up, because they're actually using that in a more thorough way. And exactly what you talk about, then spending longer with the patients who need it. I've seen that pattern too. In terms of, you say you've got practices at different stages and wanting to take the, of shifting to Total Triage. One of the best comparisons I've heard is someone describing it as, it's, and I don't know how one does this personally, but it's like doing a backflip. If you can do a backflip, you have to commit. And if you have any little moment of like indecision, you'll fall on your neck. And Total Triage, moving to it, for better or for worse, is a bit like that. So every practice we speak to says, we did some sort of soft launch. Maybe we turned it on in the morning, not the afternoon, or we did it on certain days of the week, or we had a limited number of slots. And the biggest regret was doing a soft launch and not just going for it. But it's hard, right? You're already feeling like you're treading water. To take that leap of faith is really, really hard.
Yeah, definitely. If you're watching on YouTube, Jacob's just about to do us a backflip. Like, you know, you just got to go for it. I think... yeah, I'm not going to try it. That's the only reason I couldn't do it there. If I didn't have this hand problem, backflips, no problem. Yeah, I think that's a good kind of analogy, really. It is a kind of all-in move, because it's such a radical shift. And if you get caught in that halfway house where you're getting a lot of consultations, but they're all still going to the same GP, that could be an issue. It does require a radical shift in the team. But then most PCNs, you have a lot of our staff now. We have amazing our staff, and utilizing that amazing resource is actually quite tricky, and it's something that we work on our GP partnership course. But essentially the short answer to that is that they have a different skill set to GPs, which is complementary, but only if you use it right. And if you just send them completely unfiltered patients, it doesn't really work. But if you send them patients that are right in their domain of expertise, like it is better to go and see our physio about your shoulder problem than it is to come and see me, a GP, right? Whereas...
I was going to ask, who does the triage in your practice? Is it, do you have one GP on, or like how do you run the actual triage process?
Yeah, great question. So obviously we have an acute on the day demand list, and basically everything goes on there. And we have an incredible team comprising a duty GP, paramedics, some advanced nurse practitioners. Yeah, they filter out that. But then there's other layers of filtration, if that's the right word to say. So say if someone's requesting some admin, instead of phoning up and being like, you are now 25th on hold, because we used to have terrible problems with phone answering, and all the feedback would be like, the GPs in the practice are great, but your phone line is awful. And we got cloud phones, we got more lines, we got an answer phone, and none of it really worked. The key to reducing demand on the phone, in my experience, and I definitely like to hear people's opinions in YouTube and Jacob's opinion, is giving them alternative ways to contact it. So if you need a routine bit of admin doing, you can send it via AccuRx. If you need to request a prescription, it comes via AccuRx. And that is two less phone calls that are not coming to that. And it just leaves the phone line free for those that need it. So yeah, our triage team is like a true MDT, paramedics, nurses, advanced nurse practitioners, duty GP, basically.
No, that sounds really neat, because I haven't seen such a MDT doing triage. Definitely seen he's pairing with others, but I can see how that would be very powerful, and using your team well, using your skill mix well. On the phone line piece, what we found is two things make quite a big impact. So one, we found that about 30% of the messages going through AccuRx contained the word book. And that's where actually the booking link, the booking invite came from, is we're sending, now it's 2 million messages a day, like a third of that was telling patients to call up and book. And not only is that taking a lot of reception staff time, but as a patient, it's, you've got to wait on hold, you've got to do the back and forth of, what about this time? No, what about that time? And actually, I think it was a couple of winters ago, I was due a flu jab, and I got an invite from my practice, say, call up and book. And I did the whole, oh, this date, that date, none of them worked. I was told, call back later. And I never did it, because it was just too much effort. So there's got to be a better way to do this. And that's partly where booking came from. And what's nice is we've seen that, because there are a lot of concerns are, what about patients who can't use technology? But now reception staff have the time. So the practices we speak to, they're generally spending much longer on the phone with patients in reception, but have far fewer calls. And they're able to basically take a lightweight history, take a patient's concerns and expectations to be able to feed that into triage.
Yeah, I just wrote down less calls, but longer. So we actually track our phone data with some nice cloud software. Yeah. And that's exactly what's happened. We get less calls, but the average call duration is going out longer. And when we listen to the calls, the receptionists are able to have much more in-depth conversations with the patients. And they also say, if it's appropriate, do you know next time you could do this online? Just go to our website and you can do it there. So yeah, I think like the phone thing is big. With regards to flu vaccines are beneficial for our patients. It stops them getting the flu. It's also beneficial for practices because it does generate us income, and we need income so that we can sustain our business. And what's been happening over the last few years is that we noticed that pharmacies were doing more and more of our flu jabs. So I was like, I wonder why. I looked at our patient experience, and it was exactly as you say. We would send out a letter, right? Like with a stamp on. We're spending like over 20 grand a year on postage. And it would say, phone the surgery to book your flu. You phone up, and then it's like a 5-minute to and fro. I can't do Wednesday. I've got to go to the dentist. Oh, could you do Thursday? Yeah. Oh, wait, hold on. All of that changed with just sending out the booking link. The booking link, if you're not familiar, is basically just a link. It just says, click here to book in your flu jab. It shows you the appointment choices completely automatically. And so this year, compared to last year, we have done 15% more flu jabs in our surgery than last year, because we're just using the booking link, and it makes it easier for patients. It's easier for the reception team. It's easier for everybody. So it's just like going back to that thing that if you improve communication and make it easy, people will actually choose now to use the booking link. Like sometimes people come to reception and say, I missed the text. Can you send me the booking link for the flu jab? But we're like, oh, we could just book you in now because you're here. They're like, no, I just want to use the booking link. You're like, all right, this is working. 15% more of my patients are protected from the flu. 15% more income for me in a time where GP practice income is struggling. Yesterday just announced the living wage for all the staff, which is great for staff. But guess what? That comes out of our top line. So yeah, I think like just to your theme, it's like improving the communication, isn't it?
Yeah, and the flu jab is an interesting one because that's, we see practices that you know, jumping to do that for all the reasons you outline. And the uptake one in particular, I think is, you know, really, really important because obviously with any immunization program, actually it's those marginal few percentage points of uptake and what, you know, getting towards herd immunity have a massive, massive impact. But what we've now seen is practices also going and doing the same for who are all their patients with type 2 diabetes who haven't got an HbA1c in the last year? Who are their patients on methotrexate, haven't got their bloods? And like going through, running a search, sending out a booking link and finding that they're massively improving those stats, their blood monitoring, their not just their QoF registers, because that would be a manual thing at the end of the year and they do, but actually just throughout the year, the management of patients who need those tests or who need that monitoring. And hopefully for us, it's the start of doing a lot more of this sort of automation and just making these high volume things easier. Because I find it a bit nuts that take diabetes, we all know so well exactly what we need to do to look after someone with type 2 diabetes. It's based on like decades of evidence, but only 50% of patients get all 9 processes of care, I think even less now since COVID. And that's not through like lack of trying, but it's through exactly what you talk about, getting a letter to say, go here, and you've got to call up there, and maybe the bloods haven't been ordered yet when you get there, or whatever it is. So I think the impact we can have on a lot of these things is huge. The next challenge, though, is trying to do a lot of this in secondary care, because you know, we talk about the booking example of the 5 minutes back and forth of what time can you do. In hospitals, you're not given a choice. You're just told, come on this time and date, and you know, do not DNA, that costs the system money. If you want to change it, it's quite difficult to. If you don't need the appointment, it's actually very hard to cancel. And so I've had myself as a patient this like moral dilemma of when I don't need an appointment and can't cancel it, is it better to DNA an appointment I know I don't need, or to show up to it to not DNA? And I still don't know the answer to that. But there's so much now in secondary care to address where my big concern is making sure that we don't, there's a big push, for example, on in secondary care on things like patient initiated follow-up, which is made to sound like a new concept, but it's basically how general practice has been working as long as we've been alive, which is when you need something, you get in touch. Now general practice is now on the next level. They're doing total triage, which is when you need something, you get in touch. You don't necessarily get an appointment, but you get triage. So how do we get outpatient services thinking like that? So it's not just anyone who gets PIF is used for a small number, patient-initiated follow-up is used for a small number, and when it is used, you just get an appointment. How do we get them putting all their patients on those pathways and triaging? That's a lot of what we're working with now, some more innovative trusts.
Yeah, yeah. So is that just what you did in GP, essentially, or using the similar kind of techniques and methodology, or...?
It's sharing a lot of the same, and actually internally, initially our products diverged a bit and we built separate versions for different problems. But internally, our big focus now is actually combining everything into a single product. I would say the actual implementation in a lot of cases is a lot harder in secondary care because I think that it varies by service, but there isn't the same necessarily like staff autonomy and entrepreneurialism to go and change things and innovate. I think it's quite hard to shift some of these patterns. But yeah, the underlying belief that if we put in the hands of frontline staff the ability to communicate with patients, they will innovate. And we see that. We see consultants say, right, I'm going to go through my clinic list. Anyone who needs bloods before, I'm just going to message them, make sure they get that, because I don't want to waste my time seeing a patient just to tell them to go and get bloods and then, you know, have to have them back. Any results I get that are normal, I'm not going to bother getting them in. I'm just going to tell the patient, not not bother is probably unfair. It's, I don't want to inconvenience the patient to come in. I want them to know sooner that their results are normal. So yeah, it is sharing a lot of what we've done in general practice, but the implementation, I would say, is quite complex.
Yeah. Whereas I'm glad you mentioned that, right? Because yeah, I'm slightly biased because I'm a GP, but I think that's a really good point that as a GP, if I want to change something in my practice, right? For example, we built out a new website. I thought it was amazing. I used all the kind of user interface and kind of design knowledge that I have. I met with our patient participation group, which is like a group of our patients. And they were like, yeah, we do the website, but this thing has moved and I use it all the time. And I'm like, oh, damn, like, you're right. I overlooked that. And within about a day and a half, I just completely redone that page. Now, I know from my secondary care colleagues that they just do not have, as you said, that level of autonomy, and it has to go through a board meeting, and the board meeting's not for 3 months, and then the board meeting is cancelled. And then eventually, it's just really hard to make change. Not in all cases, but yeah, that's my advert for becoming a GP partner. If you want to make changes in the business, for better or for worse, things happen really fast. And our feedback loop is really, really short because I meet with my customers, aka patients, every single day. They tell me things that don't work, and I'm like, this is great feedback. And then you can just iterate faster. Short feedback loop, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as we try and have with our products and with our users. And then there's the next big unsolved thing for us is the interface between, in particular, general practice and secondary care, but really between general practice and all providers, which is obviously a very, very sensitive topic as well, because of all the concerns around dumping or whatever it gets called. And what we tend to find is that people really, really like sending things and it being easy to send things, whichever direction that is, and don't like receiving things. But everyone acknowledges the system is broken. Everyone acknowledges like it is hopeless having a patient turn up asking for a new medication that their hospital consultant advised, but the letter isn't here yet. And it's hopeless not being able to easily get some advice from dermatology on this patient's mole. And it's hope that you can't get in touch with a patient's district nurse who's visiting them tomorrow anyway and ask them to check in on the patient. Like, so everyone knows that it's broken, but there is just understandably so much fear because everyone's so overworked and so stretched that even just a really small increase in workload has such a massive impact on impact on staff. So I'd say that's what makes this communication between orgs like particularly tricky.
Yeah, I guess like to your point about short feedback loops, like you said you lived in a GP practice for 6 months. I had the Health Tech One guys on the other day. I'm not sure if that podcast has come out yet, but they're also like literally in a GP practice. So which hospital are you moving into and where?
I've got a lot of time. I really, really like the Health Tech One team for exactly that reason. They're on the ground with users. The flagship, the trust we're spending the most time is UHL in Leicester. And so what we've spent time with a whole range of different services. And what is just how, when staff are empowered, how innovative they are. And so we've got tens and tens and tens of examples. Patients who had lung cancer and are having a monitoring CT scan every 3 months. Instead of waiting 2 weeks to find out the scan's normal, which it normally is, they get a message before they've even left the car park. And that saves the trust time and that is a much better experience for the patient. Or patients who've got surgery coming up are sent some questions a few days before to ask if their health or social circumstances have changed. And they've got a 2/3 reduction in surgical DNAs and a 50% reduction in not fit patients who attend but aren't fit for surgery. And like many, many, many examples like that, patients who are referred for PR bleeding, 2/3 get sent some questions and then 2/3 go straight to endoscopy instead of needing a first outpatient appointment. The challenge for us is like turning those into a blueprint that we can actually roll out at a much bigger scale, because it's quite, we need to get that, those little innovations, but then we also need to find a way to scale that across all different services. But Leicester's where we're trying to do a lot of that with the team and clinicians there.
Awesome. Okay, so that's like super interesting. I just want to change tack slightly. And I just like, because this podcast is about educating, informing doctors, help them with everything really. But it's also about me getting one-on-one time with the CEO of a massive, fast-growing healthcare company. I get to pick your brains for 5 minutes, if that's okay. Last time, we're at peak AI hype right now. And at Medics Money, we use AI for quite a lot of things now. In my GP practice, not so much. where do you think, it's 5 years' time, how does AI look in healthcare? And have you changed your sort of opinion on it?
It's definitely something we've been discussing quite a bit. I think that in healthcare more generally, there are certain applications where it works really well. There's a great company called Chiron we're friendly doing, using AI to look at mammography images and detect breast cancer and things that wouldn't actually have been picked up by radiologists because it can see patterns that humans can't, things like that. So there's applications like that that make perfect sense. For us in the communication space, there are definitely things we can do and we are experimenting with and looking at doing. But I think there are also some slightly unrealistic expectations around what can be done. So for example, this idea of like symptom checkers and a patient answers a load of symptoms and some sort of bot says, here's a probabilistic based differential. It's both that the tech isn't good enough, but even if the tech was good enough, if I'm ill, I want to hear it from a human, even if they're messaging me. So I think things like that will be tricky. And what we tend to find is all those algorithms, you have a sliding scale and you can either make it more sort of risk-taking and say, okay, this is probably fine and protect your capacity, but then you will miss some rare but serious events. Or you can make it far more defensive, far more risk-averse. And then you get the 111 problem, right? If everyone's told to go to A&E, go and seek advice. So I think it's very, very hard to do because of all the liability, things like that. Some of the things we're thinking about are, in particular, the assistive element. How can we recommend the most likely action take? A very, very simple example. If a patient sent a request saying, well, I've been hurting the last week. Okay, here are three options you can do. Each of them is one click or two clicks for you as a user, and you can send a Flurry to gather some structured info on their back pain. You can send a booking link for your physio to get them booked in, or you can send the template for with exercise videos from arthritis research. And taking this like assistive approach, which I sometimes describe as if we were building a car, we're not trying to be completely autonomous. We still want a human in the seat, but we're building the sat nav and the lane departure warning and the parking sensors and like all these things that make it more comfortable and safer and more efficient. I think some things are also a bit like there's a lot of talk around, for example, sorting, in triage, AI helps with sorting. And I think it can provide some value, but if you get 200 requests in and we try and sort them and then you get into the liability stuff of what if you miss, you still got to work through all of them. And so it's not actually going to relieve workload. It's just going to help prioritize a bit better, which is helpful, but we want to actually relieve workload. We're trying to find the areas we can have most impact. We've been experimenting with some clever things around using AI to actually compose content and summarize content and things like that. So I think we'll see it have more and more of a role, but definitely not going to be replacing clinical decision making.
That's good to hear. I think like at Medics Money, we think about it like it assists us, but it doesn't replace us. So for example, me and you are always going to be sat here having a chat in real life. Like we are real. This is not AI. But AI will rip the transcript of this, make a nice little blog post, which we will then look at as a human being, make sure that there's no hallucinations, like factual inaccuracies. And so it's going to speed up or like repetitive processes, but it's not at the moment going to replace us on the podcast. And then if I think about how that translates through into my job as a GP, I think if you're trying to relieve GPs or clinicians of boring repetitive tasks and pattern recognition, amazing. But if you're trying to replace GPs with a bot, you might struggle. And that kind of brings me on to my next more controversial question, because of course, Babylon, they were famous for having an AI bot. And regrettably recently, despite being Matt Hancock's favorite healthcare company, that they've gone bust. So what impact has the demise of Babylon had on your sector? Because there was a lot of promise there, and ultimately, I think it's fair to say, didn't deliver. What's been the impact on your industry, and what did you learn from that?
So I'll go back a bit further and actually start with, and I have a lot of thoughts on them as a company, but one of the positive impacts they had when they were growing is that and this was before COVID, they started to shift some of the conversations we were having with practices, and particularly putting more emphasis on patient experience and like digital patient access. So we would talk to practices who would say, it would say, make it more easy for your patients to get in touch. And they'd say, no, they can call up. And then it shifted to, oh no, but we're actually competing with this GP at hand service, which they never really were at scale, because I think most patients did just want to stick, very understandably, with their NHS, sort of traditional NHS GP practice. But it did shift some of the conversation and move forward some of the expectations around patient digital access, which in terms of the demise, so to speak, it hasn't impacted us massively because we're not trying to do the same things. So one, we're not a provider, we're a software as a service. That is our general view, is the health system, the NHS in this country is actually very, very good at providing healthcare. It just has some pretty atrocious technology, and that's what we want to help with. And some of the sort of care delivery operations around that. So we're not a provider. We're not trying to diagnose patients, which is just really, really, really hard to do. I remember a few years ago having barn door shingles, going through the symptom tracker, and it was you couldn't handle it because shingles hadn't been put in there. I think it's just said this is likely to be a cosmetic reaction to cosmetics. So it hasn't actually had an impact in that sense. We've got a few of the team who've joined from there who are brilliant, and so that's released some of the talent that was at Babylon to the wider ecosystem. We're not fundraising at the moment. Maybe it would make investors more cautious of our space, just having been a company that was valued at whatever it was, 4.2 billion in their SPAC that then essentially liquidated. So I don't know. But those have been some of the impacts or non-impacts.
I think it's... Do you think they were just too early in some senses? Because, I don't know, I just think in 10 years' time, someone might get quite close to what they said they could or would do.
So I think they were trying to do lots and lots of different things. So I think it's hard to even pull out, okay, which one of those do we think is what could have really taken off? The GP at hand part, they face the reality that with a GMS or an APMS contract, like, you're on very thin margins. And if you run things really, really well, you can make a business out of it. But if you give... The interesting thing is they gave unlimited demand, but without triaging. So I'm actually very big on opening up access and making it... Sorry, unlimited access without triaging. I'm very big on opening up access and making it really, really easy for patients to get in touch. And what we find... from almost every total triage practice is they actually work on making it easier and easier for patients to submit requests rather than harder, so that patients don't just default to calling up, and so that they get used to that behavior. But then they triage, whereas this, like, anytime you want, you can speak to a doctor on video. Any company could do that if you had a bottomless pit of money, but actually on the 150 quid a year you get for your global sum, it's very, very hard to... Maybe you just can't run a business like that. On some of the AI stuff, I just maybe it'll be a generational thing. Maybe there'll be a generation in 20 years' time who's actually more comfortable getting a diagnosis from an algorithm than from a human. Maybe it's the same generation who'll be more comfortable cars whizzing around without drivers in the seats than cars without drivers. Even if today the stats are probably that the driverless ones might be safer than humans in a lot of circumstances. So maybe there'll be a generational shift. But for us, it all goes back to let's sort out the fax machines, let's sort out the pagers, let's sort out there's been decades of talk of integration in healthcare, which I think of as everyone involved in patients' care working as one team. Imagine if you and I were in the same team and we could only communicate by dictating a letter that may or may not arrive 2 weeks later, or by you calling a switchboard waiting and then me getting disturbed by this bleep, I have no idea what it is, and then by the time I call back, you've had to go and do something else. Like, we'd never get anything done. So how on earth are we going to integrate primary, secondary care, physical, mental health, health and social care, if we can't get the absolute, absolute basics right? And I'm not talking about like snazzy algorithms diagnosing patients. I'm talking about really, really basic things that are solved in other sectors. Like, communication is healthcare has a lot of quite unique challenges, which I think make it really interesting problems for us to solve. But we've got to solve a lot of these basics.
Yeah, there's just plenty of low-hanging fruit to pick before we have a robot doing triage and diagnosing patients. If we can just pick the low-hanging fruit, leave the clinicians to do what they're best at, that'd be awesome. Yeah, Babylon, the GP at hand side of things specifically, I think that illustrates a really important point for people that don't know, which is that a GP practice gets a set pot of money per year to look after you, whether you go visit me one time or 350 times. And I think that makes it incredibly challenging because as a GP in the NHS, my responsibility is to utilize the NHS resources as appropriately as I can. I would love to visit every single one of my patients at home every single day, right? And the NHS would just go, my practice would just go bust. I think maybe what Babylon, they just didn't seem to understand how tough the business of NHS GP is, because if you open up demand, like you say, and say you're encouraging demand, but you're still in the private sector, the more times a patient comes to you, the more you get paid. In the NHS, the more times a patient comes to you, the less you get paid. That is a fundamental concept, which I don't know. They must have understood it, but it looked like they didn't.
The last thing I'd say, actually, specifically on capitation, is that I don't think we appreciate how big a driver for innovation that is. Because if we went to, you know, if we went to France or US or wherever next year and rolled out our communication product and started speaking about, oh, now you can resolve these requests asynchronously so you don't have to see a patient, that's lost income. Whereas because of capitation here, primary care innovates and becomes more productive and becomes more efficient. And so I don't think we realize how big a driver it is for innovation and the partnership model as well. And I know there's politicians go round of a partnership model, but like primary care wouldn't work without it, I don't think. So it is a big driver of innovation and productivity.
Yeah, it's just, so you show me the incentive, I show you the outcome, and my incentives as an NHS GP are perfectly aligned with my patients because I just want to use the valuable resources that I have, the NHS, for the right people at the right time. Whereas, as you say, it sounds like you're expanding to America. Congratulations, look forward to that. But there, the more times that you go and see your GP, your GP gets paid. In this country, the more times you come and see me, the less I get paid. So it's like we're incentivized as partners to make sure that we maximize the value of NHS resource, which is really cool. All right, we're way off track here. Last question, I promise, because this is like our chance to pick your brains. We have a lot of doctors now who are looking to move into this health tech space because I think as a doctor, I'm seeing one patient at a time. I have no leverage. I can just do one patient at a time. The reason I like this kind of space is that I can make a change to my practice's workflow or the way that we deal with a certain request. And I can influence, in my case, tens of thousands of patients that are on my list. I think that if you in health tech as a doctor, you could influence millions of patients. So when you are hiring, imagine you're a doctor listening to this and you've got some good ideas or you think that you might be into health tech. What do you look for when you're recruiting clinicians at AcuRx? Because you've got loads of clinicians. I met loads of your clinicians. They're just like normal doctors like us. What do you look for?
So in our clinical leads, we're looking for a few things. One is that innovation. So even with the tools they have available, they're like working at the edge of those tools. They're like using the way they create searches and reports and the way they use us and the way they use other products. They're like working at the edge and almost like breaking those things to achieve, you know, achieve great things for their patients and for their practice and its productivity. I'd say another one which is really hard to find but crucial is really, really good pragmatism around clinical risk, but it's also just like behavioral design and like how people use software, because we, you know, we've got to make sure our software isn't overwhelming, but that people don't miss things. And there's lots of like micro decisions that we take every day around how notifications are sent and how we let you search a list of things and what templates you see. And I think a really, really key skill is having, you know, understanding what are like credible risks, and then how do you find clever product solutions to mitigate them rather than just filling the product with like warnings or not letting people do things. I'd say that's a really, really key skill. And then I think the other is a like real inquisitiveness. So a lot of our clinical leads are going and working in other care settings, and accurates are working in other care settings that maybe they haven't trained in or they haven't worked in much before, or even in a care setting they know well, but actually they've just seen a certain slice of it. And so I think clinicians who come in with enough expertise to know how the health system works, talk the language, understand when a patient has hypertension, what does that actually mean what, in terms of their management and the medications they're on, or whatever the example is, but then also aren't too anchored by that and are quite willing to challenge things and say, hang on a sec, why are we bringing all these patients in, or why are those things referrals? Why can't the GP resolve them themselves or get advice or point them to a community clinic? So I think that like inquisitiveness and like constant challenging of the status quo is super important.
That's super helpful for, I know that lots of people listening are like looking to get into this space because it's exciting. Jacob, that was awesome. What's the best way? Is it just accurex.co.uk? How do we find out about, if we want to start total triage, where do we go?
Yeah, accurex.com, and go there. There's a page on total triage. You can get our recovering access report and blueprint from there or from our social media. So we've committed to getting 1,000 practices up and using total triage by end of Q1 next year, and have a load of different support in place for those practices to do that, free trials, body exams, loads of learning resources, things like that. So yeah, please do check that out and do feel free to get in touch.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming to our conference last week. Gutted I couldn't make it, but I had some great feedback. And yeah, let's catch up again soon.
I'd love that, Tommy. Thanks a lot.